WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the Tony Award Ceremony Sunday night, Uta Hagen will receive a special Lifetime Achievement Award. I've heard many actors say with reverence that they studied at the HB Studio in New York, which she runs. It was founded by her late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in 1945. Some of the actors who studied there include Jack Lemmon, Stocker Channing, Matthew Broderick, Maureen Stapleton, and Lily Tomlin. Many actors have studied Uta Hagen's books, Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. Uta Hagen started her acting career over 60 years ago and worked with now legendary people including Eva Le Gallien, the Luntz, and Paul Robeson. She was born in Germany and moved to Madison, Wisconsin at the age of 6 when her father accepted a position teaching art history at the University of Wisconsin. I spoke with her last November when she was starring in the off-Broadway production Collected Stories. You're known as a great teacher as well as a great actor, and you've written a couple of books about acting. You write that there are hundreds of different people within you who surface through the day, within anyone who surface through the day. Do you recommend that actors find the person within them that's closest to the role that they're playing?
Well, it isn't one person in you. In other words, when you create a role, you are selecting from various aspects of your life and putting it together to create that new character. But all of that has to spring from your understanding of yourself. And that's what takes so long.
You say that an experience that has served you many times, including when you played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, is an experience from your childhood when you were like pelted with hard snowballs by kids in the neighborhood, and you were called an atheist. What is it from that scene that stayed with you so much, from that experience? And
well, it was a bitter, cold winter night. I was hounded through the streets with snowballs by children. That's terrifying. I'd never forgot it. It was like being in hell.
What is it from that experience that you summon up when you need to for a role?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering if there is a kind of experience that is so frightening or rich for you, if you've used it to draw on several times for roles, does the experience dry up? Does it lose
No.
its power to
No,
have that energy for you?
As a matter of fact, that experience might wear out because I've talked about it a lot. If you don't talk about it a lot, it stays useful. When you explain to an audience, to somebody, a friend, a colleague who's working with you, what sources you're using, if you tell them that, your secret is gone. Now they look at you with that knowledge of what you're using and judging it, and you can't use it anymore.
That's interesting. So you won't talk about these things with the people you're performing with?
No.
But you'll talk about it with your students?
Not what I'm using in the immediate role. I give them examples like the snowball.
Right.
Now, that's used up for me because I've talked about it a lot.
In one of your books about acting, you talk about how you can't be inert on stage and you have to find out what it is that you actually do while you think you're doing nothing so that you could do that kind of thing on stage. Have you thought about that a lot, what it is you're doing when you're...
I'm
really
going to interrupt
anything.
You right now.
Go ahead.
Because, again, everything you're discussing, you have read, it interests you. Are you an actor?
No, I'm not.
Then it's none of your business. Now, let me explain to you why. It may interest you, may fascinate you, but I feel that in the theater, everybody thinks they can act. Everybody is fascinated about another human being on stage. If it's very convincing, they usually are sure that they could do it too, which is not true at all. If you would go to a violinist, you would not ask him about his bowing arm, about his elbow position, about his phrasing. And if he told you, you wouldn't know what he's talking about, and you would be bored. If you went to a painting class and a watercolor class and you saw a teacher showing somebody how to put how to wash a piece of paper that is going to have watercolor put on it in a minute, you'd say, what are they teaching here? How they're watering down a page? These are not the secrets, but the craft itself. You wouldn't ask a scientist because you wouldn't know what he was talking about, and you must I feel an audience should learn to respect acting as a craft in the same way that you, if I do explain it, it'll might titillate you. You might understand a little of it, but the real impact or import of it for a fellow artist, you would not get.
I don't
say that to offend you. I just believe that with all my heart.
I want to say I totally respect what you're saying, but I just beg to differ on a couple of things. That for example, I would be asking the violinist about their phrasing and the bend of their arm and all of that.
Why?
Well, because I think...
Do you play violin?
No, but...
Then I think you might ask him, but I think the violinist would look at you like you were nuts, and I think you are.
No, see, what I have found as someone very interested in these things is that, for instance, if the violinist talks to me about his or her phrasing, it might help me hear music, hear things in music that I didn't hear before. I find that actually understanding more about craft is not only interesting in its own right, but helps me perceive things that I didn't perceive before, which I like.
That's a very valid point. And maybe I'm just in reaction to so many people who ask these questions the misunderstanding of the layman in terms of an acting technique are so profound that I think I've pretty much had it in my life with that. I think that's probably part of my rebellion.
I'll tell you another reason why I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about acting, though I respect you for not wanting to talk about this, is that I think really good actors have great insights into the body and how the body is used, how the body communicates, how the voice communicates, and also that great actors are great observers of other people, and they just have great insights into...
That's true.
How
and I think,
move.
But you see, the body again, which I'm a gung ho about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about it all the time, but I believe that the body as a instrument of communication is all powerful. And the biggest influence in my life for that training came from modern dance, without being balletic or dancerish, but it very strongly influenced me. However, very fine actors very often cannot define themselves what it is they are doing. Lorette Taylor could not tell you what she was doing. She had no idea. She was intuitive, instinctive, great performer.
I've certainly noticed that as an interviewer, that some of the really great artists I've interviewed...
Oh, God, some of the best ones I happen to have because I've been teaching, and I found in my own work that very often... when I couldn't explain something, it was because I didn't understand it myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I couldn't articulate it, it was because it was fuzzy in my own head. Now, I do know that I can do it, nevertheless, but I may not be able to communicate it to someone else.
Perhaps you'll let me ask you about the voice, since I do speak on the radio.
Yes.
I know that... you've recommended singing lessons for people who aren't necessarily going to be singing on stage but are just going to be speaking. What do you feel you've learned about your voice from studying singing? I'm assuming you've studied it.
I did. You see, it's the same with when I say dance, modern mm-hmm. dance, for mm-hmm. the body of the actor, which does not make them self-conscious about stage movement but gives them a sense of alignment, a sense of an awareness of their body and space. In the same way, singing, rather than voice for the theater, makes them not listen to themselves. It prepares the vocal instrument, the diaphragm, the whole tone of the voice in the head. Without making you now listen to yourself when you talk. Do you understand what I mean? The self-consciousness, when it makes you listen how it sounds, you're going to be a bad actor. The voice has to be there for you, to serve you when the time comes.
Right. So you're not worrying about how you're doing your lines.
Exactly.
You're learning about the sound and physicality of your voice.
Exactly. It's there from the singing. It serves, the instrument is ready. It's primed.
We're listening to a 1998 interview with actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Sunday she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Your acting career was launched by what I perceive to be as a very bold gesture. When you were, I think, 17, you wrote a letter to Eve Le Gallienne asking if you could work with her.
Yep.
And I think that's a very brave thing to do.
I didn't even think it was brave. I was also very stupid. I thought she still had the civic repertory, which I knew, had read a great deal about and heard about. And it was the only repertory company in America at the time. There hasn't been one since, I don't think, a real repertory company. And she was doing great plays and contemporary new playwrights and Ibsen and Chekhov and Shakespeare. And that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be a part of that. And based on that, I wrote her and I said, this is what I want, and could I audition for you, and I want to be a part of your theater. And didn't realize that the Civic had already folded, and she was still functioning, but not in that capacity. And then she was working on a production of Hamlet, which I didn't know. And I went home after my audition with her, and in spring of 36, no, 37. And then I was, my father wanted me to go to college, and because at that time you couldn't get a job at Macy's if you didn't have a degree. It was during the Depression. And I was itching to just go into the theater. I didn't want to do college. So I thought I'll do it in a 3-year plan and take summer school. And I went to enroll in summer school and came home, and there was a letter from Miss Le Gallienne asking if I would be interested in coming east and working with her on Hamlet. And that was my debut in the theater, Ophelia.
Now, was that letter based on her having seen you or just based on your letter?
No, based on my letter. My letter to her.
What did you say in that letter?
I don't know.
That invitation?
I really don't know how I used to persuade people that I was fabulous because I guess I believed it. And I don't know how I interested, my agent said to me, who was my agent at the time, she said, I don't know, when you walked in, you knew you were great, so we believed it. And I don't think I had egomania at all. I just believed I had a big talent and I was going to be a great actress.
So what was it like for you playing Ophelia so early in your career?
I don't remember. You see, it's all like a haze and blur. It was a wonderful experience, and then in essence I studied with her because I worked with her in the play and that whole company with fencing lessons, and we had all sorts of extracurricular things we were asked to do. And we wove our own costumes at her looms, and it was a phenomenal experience for me. And then when that was finished, which went very well at Dennis, we played it in Dennis, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and got wonderful reviews from Elliot Norton and all the fine Boston critics. And then she was going to do eight plays in repertory and work on it for 3 years. She had a huge grant for that, and I was going to be part of that. And then I rehearsed with her for 3 months, and she abandoned the whole thing because she felt the company wasn't good enough, which I don't think it was. And so I worked with her on The Seagull. I worked with her in other roles in the fall. And then at Christmas, the whole thing was collapsed. And then I went on to do The Seagull with the Lunts. I don't believe it. When I laugh, it's because it's like some fairy tale.
Now, you worked with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine on Broadway in The Seagull. These are like great names of the theater, but most people today have never seen them perform and know them only through legend. What were they like? What was so special about them?
Well, they were an enormous influence on my life. They if I say only one thing, of discipline. I've never, what they pounded into me in terms of theater discipline has never left me. And I've tried to pass that on because I'm very shocked most of the time at young actors who don't understand what a disciplined performer is like in terms of the simplest things of your own health, of your rest, of your readying yourself for work, of the hours you put into work. I can work 12 hours in a row and not fall down. And the respect for the craft, for the love for the theater, the need to make it into a true offering for an audience, I mean, I knew some of these things before, but they were kind of reconfirmed, and I saw it in practice. They were phenomenal.
When you say they taught you discipline, could you elaborate on what it was that they taught you that helped you with discipline?
Well, they were disciplinarians in the toughest sense of the word. You were, if your curtain was at 8:30 in those days, your half hour was at 7, at 8, you were in the theater at 6:30, and not a moment later. Somebody like Clarence Derwent, who was the president of Equity at one point, very prominent actor, played with them in The Pirate, and he played the part of the pirate who didn't appear until the third act. That was at 10 o'clock. He was still in the theater at 6:30. And the no-nonsense backstage, never, you don't drink during the day, you don't come to the theater in a messy state, you look after your costumes. Miss Fontaine used to sit with me trying to teach me a decent makeup, which I'd had classes in for years. And she would smack my hands if while I was putting on my eyebrow pencil, said, no. She would say, you make up for the, not for the last row gallery with opera glasses, but for somebody in the front row with opera glasses. And that's what I'm talking, and how that you don't have on a beautiful costume and have a malted milk and spill it in your lap. In other words, everything had to do with true care about everything you did and everything you brought to a performance.
In 1943, you played Desdemona to Paul Robeson's Othello. What was it like to work opposite Robeson?
Well, it was wonderful. He was an unbelievably overused term, but charismatic man with a great presence, an enormous intelligence, a sense of humor. He was a great, great man.
Was there anything that was considered controversial about the production?
Everything was considered controversial. That's why.
Because so often Othello was played by a white actor in blackface.
It was the first time in this country. No, mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe in some. I just was trying to think who else had played it. I don't want to have history cockeyed here, but it was for a Broadway production. Way ahead of its time in that sense, and that made it very controversial and very exciting, and no trouble at all. Everybody was thrilled with the idea that this was finally happening.
Now, am I right in saying that you were later blacklisted?
Oh, yes, I was blacklisted for 10 years.
And
as a matter of fact, I was graylisted in 1970. I did a production for CBS, and I said, there was a woman producer called Barbara Schultz, and I said, did you have any trouble getting me on? And she said, oh, God, yes. That was still in 1970.
And do you think that related at all to your work with Robeson?
It did.
And your friendship with Robeson?
It did, no question about it. I also was a progressive and a political, what would I still call myself, a liberal, left liberal Democrat. Always was, and I always will be. And it was that one time in my life when I would say I was very proud to be an American citizen because I felt I was very active as such. And the blacklisting and the what happened to me as a result, I say the government still owes me an apology.
So you lost a lot of roles that you think
well,
you would have had.
Well, of course. Yeah. Oh, I know. And it was at the kind of the most fruitful part of my career. I had just done Blanche for 2 years. I had done The Country Girl. I had done St. Joan. And suddenly, and I was beginning to get big television offers. I never got another television. I never got another film offer. St. Joan was supposed to go on the road. I couldn't go on the road because they were writing the Guild protest letters from Indianapolis, from all over the country. And And the worst thing they did, I don't really care, I say, about that, because I think, in a way, maybe it prevented me from being tempted by movies and stuff that I would have been sorry I did afterwards. But what they did to me spiritually was that it's the only time in my life I was ever frightened. I've never been frightened of anything in my life. And that scared me, and that's what I resent most.
Did you have to testify?
No, twice. I mean, I had I was called twice. I only testified once eventually in private session. But those were horrible days. Those were days when you sat in a restaurant, and if you started to talk politics, you looked over your shoulder to see if a waiter was listening, was going to report you. My phone was tapped. I was followed by the FBI. And nobody ever even asked me to be a communist. That's what's so ironic about that whole time.
Uta Hagen recorded last year. Sunday, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1998 interview with actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Sunday night, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. Hagen runs the HB Acting Studio and is the author of the books Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. She started her career over 60 years ago and worked with such theater legends as Eva Le Gallien, The Luntz, and Paul Robeson. In 1947, you worked with the director Harold Clurman, and you say that he took away all your tricks and brought you into a more modern approach to acting. What were the tricks that he stripped you of?
Well, the tricks, what you learn, actually, he stripped me of stuff that I had acquired as a professional, which was pretty junky, you know, but Broadway tricks, you tell a funny joke just before you enter the stage, that makes you into a professional, which is junk. And slick entrances and how to sit and how to move gracefully and self-aware and theatrically, externally theatrically phony, which I did not begin with, by the way. As an amateur, I said, Clurman led me back to being a good amateur, which is that I believed who I was, I believed where I was, I had faith in what I was doing, I was not dishing it out front for consumption, and he wouldn't let me do. I had learned to fix line readings, to fix gestures, and he didn't let me do any of that, and I got back to where I'd been, and only now I believe that it could be done that way and wasn't amateurish, but was true.
You met your late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in the theater. He was an actor and teacher, and you run the studio that he founded. Did you meet him in a play? Were you on stage together?
Yes, we were in a play with Clurman, as a matter of fact. It was the same play called The Whole World Over by Konstantin Simonov. Not a very good play. And he was a replacement. And I had heard about him, and through many of my acting colleagues, many of them studied with him. I thought he was a phony, it was a guru. At the few meetings I had with him, I thought it was a strange man. And then we started working together, and were love scenes, and a couple of kisses, and a couple of hugs, and a week later we hit the sack and we never left.
No, I
44 years later.
I imagine it's a very kind of intensified experience to be in love with somebody on and off stage, to enact this dramatic love on stage and to also feel it off stage.
I don't think it's that so much. It's working together. I think it needn't have been a love scene for us to fall in love with each other.
Uh-huh.
But what was extraordinary about our relationship from then on was that we truly did everything together. I mean, he'd got me into teaching. He's the one who started me teaching. And I said, I don't know how to teach. Why do you want me to teach? And he said, you know how to act. Can't you learn to pass on what you've learned? And when he put it that way, I thought, that'll be fun. And then from then on, I loved it. And we had the studio together, and we played together for many, many years. And he directed me in many plays. And it was a unique, fabulous life that I still can't believe is gone.
My guest is actress and teacher Uta Hagen. Did you ever study, you know, the method?
No, never. I mean, I've read all of Stanislavski's books avidly when I was young, and I still have my old copies that are all underlined with "so true" on the side. You know? I didn't really know why. And I also remember thinking, why can't I do what he's telling me when I get on stage? As a matter of fact, that when I was asked to write my book, I was actually commissioned to write the first one by Macmillan, I said, it can't be done, because And it drove me crazy because I said, I can demonstrate something in 1 second that it takes me 30 pages to write. And got so bored with it. But my books are actually based on things that gave me problems as an actor. Mm-hmm. And every exercise, thing I came up with was based on my own problems, sharing those with other actors, which I think most of those problems every actor has had himself. When people say, oh, how do you know that? I say, because there isn't a mistake I haven't made. There isn't a mistake in the book that I haven't made 10 times, 100 times. So then I see it in someone else, then I can help them get rid of that problem.
You mentioned that first book about acting that you wrote. You've in a way disavowed that book, and you have a second book about acting. What was the problem with the first book?
Well, when I was watching an exercise in class, and I was appalled, and I very rarely get impatient, and this time I did, and I said, my God, what's the matter? Didn't you read my book? And she said, yes. And I said, where does it say to do what you just did? She brought me the book, and there was some sentence there. And I said, oh, no. And I hadn't looked at the book in 12 years. And I took it home. I reread it. I said, this has got to go. And I immediately started to revise it and spend another 5 years writing the new one. And theoretically, I agree with many of the things in the first book. But it's cute. It's superficial. It's convenient. I think it can be misinterpreted. I teach all of it. I've taught a lot in colleges. They say, I'm working from your book, and they're doing the opposite of what I say. They have managed to say what I wrote and interpreted the opposite. So I thought, this mustn't be. So I wrote the new one, and I think you might not know, people might not like it as much, but they might disagree with it. You can't even disagree with the first one. It's so general.
I wonder if you have actors who you've taught, who you've seen changed by working in Hollywood and achieving stardom there.
I've seen, if they're talented and manage to get over the idiocy of Hollywood, they usually change for the better. But if they improve, but if they, I've seen professional actors. Stars whom I worked with who were theater actors who were quite extraordinary and wonderful. And they go to Hollywood for 6, 7, 8 years and they do sitcoms or they do nothing but movies and they come back and they are scared to death. They cannot sustain a performance. They tense up. They have not used their bodies. They're all used to close-ups and have really lost their ability. And that's a fact. I know 4 very specific examples that were you shudder.
Uta Hagen, recorded last November. Sunday night, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. This is Fresh Air.